You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, May the 9th, and it's time for the Week in Review. Every Friday at this time, we invite in two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the news of the week, the political news of the week. And we've got lots of politics to talk about this hour, national, international, and state of Wisconsin. I'm sure we're going to spend a considerable amount of time on what I think is probably the top political story of the week, that being the outcome of the Indiana and North Carolina primaries and the fallout and where this race for the White House goes from here. We will welcome your thoughts and questions on that. Should Hillary drop out? Why isn't she? And any other news of the week that you'd like to talk about, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We are happy to have with us today Peg Lautenschlager. She's an attorney with Lawton and Cates in Madison. Former Wisconsin Attorney General, former U.S. Attorney, former state lawmaker, and a brand new, newly designated pledged Obama delegate from the 6th Congressional District. Good morning.
Good morning.
That just happened. You were just elected
Sunday, a caucus in Kiel, yes.
Well, we'll talk about that. Also with us, Margaret Farrow. She's a former lieutenant governor, active in public policy-related organizations. She is chair of the board of Wisconsin Eye, the state's version of C-SPAN, our public affairs network, and she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, Peg. We go way back, don't we?
We do. It's been a while. It's nice to be able to talk today.
We served together in the assembly many years ago.
There we go. I didn't know.
It's so many years ago that the daughter I had while I was in the assembly is graduating from high school next month, Margaret. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you've got a long history in politics, both of you, and let's talk about what happened on Tuesday. Here first is Hillary Clinton following her very narrow win in Indiana.
Not too long ago, my opponent made a prediction. He said I would probably win Pennsylvania, he would win North Carolina, and Indiana would be the tiebreaker. Well, tonight, we've come from behind, we've broken the tie, and thanks to you, it's full speed on to the White House.
And Barack Obama had a much bigger win in North Carolina on Tuesday, a 14 percentage point victory.
You know, there are those who were saying that North Carolina would be a game changer in this election. But today, what North Carolina decided is that the only game that needs changing is the one in Washington, D.C.
So, Obama supporter Peg Lautenschlager, what's your take on the primary election results?
Well, you know, I think that the path is pretty clear that it's fair to say Obama's going to be the presumptive nominee, assuming that, you know, some shoe doesn't drop or something come from the heavens or whatever. But I think he's been very wise in terms of playing this as though not to assume anything and also to move forward in a way where he both continues with the primary process, but secondly, starts to map out a game plan for a strategy in November. And I think it's shown his judgment and his maturity and his willingness to move forward and yet give Hillary Clinton her own time and space, which, given the way the primaries have gone, I think that's not an easy task for either one of them.
Mm. Margaret Farrow, what do you make of it?
Well, I think, you know, we just see an ongoing kind of push and shove in that it is so even, really. But I guess my concern would be looking at the two who are still standing, and I know there's a question whether, you know, there are those who wish Hillary Clinton would bow out somehow gracefully at this point, and yet she has won the states that are the Electoral College-heavy vote states. And Obama has not won those states. And I think if I were in in the other side, if I were in the Democratic Party, I'd be concerned about November in that regard. And to his credit, I think Obama, on the other hand, has had very, very good structure in his campaign. People, I think, on all sides really respect the way the campaign has been run. He's managed to hire and get around him the type of a structure for a campaign that is working to this point. At this point, though, he's going to have to begin to put some real substance or flesh on the bones of what he's been saying, and I think that's what people are waiting to see, whereas Hillary Clinton, you know, probably feels she's a veteran of those issues and could carry them forward.
Well,
it's going to continue to be interesting. I think it's been far too long for everyone. I wish we could somehow shorten this process, because I don't know how the candidates are managing to handle this for so long, and I certainly know the public, except as it reaches a fever pitch in each state for the primary, the public as a whole is getting pretty weary of it.
I think you're right on the weariness, Margaret. The one thing I would say, however, is that, you know, Hillary Clinton has pretty much predicated her experience based on her experiences as First Lady in Arkansas and her experiences as a First Lady in the White House and her experience in a big law firm as a very junior person there originally. And I have a hard time buying into somehow she has focused on herself as being the experienced one. Barack Obama's community activism is something that shouldn't be discounted, and in fact is something that I think would probably serve a lot of elected officials well had they had that experience. As a state legislator, some of the legislation he passed statewide was, nationally noted and emulated by other states to deal with things like eyewitness identification in a situation like Illinois in the criminal justice field, where that was a huge issue at the time, where all the prisoners were on death row and many of them there because of eyewitness identifications. We saw how that blew up in Wisconsin. But he really did a number of things as a state legislator. I wouldn't discount that. And as a federal legislator, as a U.S. senator, he's jumped right in on issues of importance to him. And I think that the ethics stuff is huge. And Margaret, I think we're probably on the same team in terms of our frustrations with the way the political process has changed. And I think he's been an articulate spokesperson for trying to get back to reality there.
Let me talk about what Hillary Clinton said yesterday in an interview with USA Today. I have a much broader base to build a winning coalition on, she said in the interview. She said Senator Obama's support among working, hardworking Americans, white Americans, is weakening again, and how whites in both states had not completed college were supporting me. Is that troubling to you, Peck?
Oh, it's horribly troubling. And I think it typifies the difference between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And, you know, it's interesting because I see it generationally in my family. My daughter is actually a Hillary supporter. She's 17. But our boys, who are all in their 20s, are Obama supporters. And I think how they view race and how they view differences, how they view gender, how they view sexual orientation and whatever is very different than for those of us who are 50 or older. And I think that they aren't want to categorize people in ways where there's a white man over there, oh, there's an Hispanic man over there, whatever. And I think they view that differently. And I think the fact that she has so focused on that as the reason for her electability is almost offensive to all those kids who are coming out to vote, all the people of color who are coming out to vote, everybody else who fits into these categories, which the media and she as a candidate seem to want to put folks in. And I think that's sad.
Yeah, but Margaret Farrow's any truth to what she's saying?
Well, I think there is looking from the outside in, and Peg certainly is in the inside of what's going on in the party on that side, and I'm viewing it from my perspective. But I think that Hillary Clinton does have kind of a multi-age coverage in terms of those who are concerned, as they say, about the glass ceiling and other things. So she's covering several generations. I know, as people know, those staged backgrounds behind the candidates on important speeches or election night results, you always see everything you can mix behind you, and they certainly have young people involved and young women involved. On the other hand, I don't see any difference in the way the Obama race has quite frankly, looked at the race side of it and utilized that. And understandably, from a human standpoint, been able to motivate electors who, people who have gone to the polls who haven't voted before, who haven't been as excited as they are. So I think both of them, as candidates, are looking to a very specific backing from the gender or the race side of the issue. And the concern should be for the party is how you pull it together, because the interesting statistics we keep saying, and I'm not a big poll watcher, but the polls in exit polls and other polls say that a number of those supporting Hillary Clinton would not vote for Obama. Those supporting Obama say they wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton. And I think that would be a concern for me if I were looking at the fall election.
Well, you know, and I think it's a concern for anybody. I'm, you know, from my perspective, Margaret, I think McCain's going to be such a horrendous candidate that it's mm-hmm. you know, maybe all of this discussion is moot, or at least that's my hope. But I do think that, you know, number one, McCain hasn't been vetted, and I don't think he's going to be able to use his age as his excuse for issues that had come up in the past and have kind of been swept under the rug now. But I also think that, you know, Obama's coalition is a different kind of coalition, if you want to look at it in those terms. And, you know, the number of Republicans he's pulling over to his side, other than perhaps the Indiana Rush Limbaugh Operation Chaos or whatever it was called. But other than that, you've seen that a lot of people who either view themselves as independents or view themselves as moderate Republicans are moving his way. And I think he's creating a different paradigm in terms of how you approach politics. And for those of us who are accustomed to the more traditional kind of politics, I think it's very frustrating. But, you know, to me, what's hurt Hillary Clinton isn't as much her position on policies or her policy wonkishness or whatever you want to call it. But I think the tragedy to Hillary Clinton is that what has allowed her to buoy herself up into this position of national notoriety has been the Clinton, her husband's presidency and the surroundings of it. But that's the same group of folks who I think in many ways are pulling her down, in part because of the practicality of her positions on issues, but also in part because of a kind of the I don't know, I wouldn't want to say in terms of the questionable nature of the politics and the politics of money that comes with that campaign.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing, though, is if any of us had been having this conversation a year ago or even 9 months ago, and you would have said, well, write down on a piece of paper who are going to be left standing, who are going to be the finalists in all of this. Interestingly, I think the only one who probably would have appeared on some people's list would have been Hillary Clinton.
Oh, absolutely, Margaret. And, you know, to me, some of the more phenomenal things about the Obama thing is, you know, they said, well, he'd never raise enough money. Well, how do you raise this much money on the internet from small donors, you know? And that kind of thing where he really has broken the rules in a variety of ways. And yet come, you know, and every time the bar is set somewhere, he jumps and meets the bar. So I think that from that standpoint, it's just been a fascinating thing to watch.
We have full lines, and most everybody wants to talk about the Democratic presidential race. We will take your calls after this short break, and we will move on to other issues as well, as this is The Week in Review, talking with Peg Lautenschlager and Margaret Farrow, and you, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. This is The Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. And after 4, as he does every Friday after 4, it's Your Views on the News. Ben will be talking with a professor of political science at UW-Madison, David Cannon. And we will welcome your thoughts about the week's top news story after 4 o'clock this afternoon. We're reviewing the news of the week with Peg Lautenschlager and Margaret Farrow. And our first caller is Judy in Reedstown. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm sorry to have to say this. I supported Hillary Clinton's campaign, and I voted for her in the Wisconsin primary. But after the primaries in Indiana and North Carolina, it seemed to me like she was sounding and seeming an awful lot like a George W. Bush. Stubborn, unrealistic, spinning stuff. And maybe just pursuing this simplistic image, a tough broad, just like his cowboy image or whatever that is that he does. I hope that she will reconsider, leave the race, and preserve her dignity. I thought she was a good candidate. I'm sorry it went this way, but it did.
She's trying to be a fighter, though, too, isn't she, Peg?
Well, you know, it's a tough, and Margaret, and you know this as well as I do, it's a tough line for women to walk and in politics, I think, because there is, you know, people want you to be feminine, but they want you to be tough. And I think we're getting over those barriers now. But that's certainly something which I think has confronted all of us as candidates. And she certainly, you know, I mean, she did remarkable things. The fact that she moved to New York and picked a state and runs for U.S. Senate and gets elected to me was overwhelmingly wild in my estimation. Who would have thought? But I think you see now somebody who, you know, I don't know, but one of the national news commentators mentioned as she gave her speech in Indiana that the most telling thing about the speech was watching Bill Clinton in the background. And I know I was watching it at home with a number of friends who've done political things with me for decades. And we all were taking note of Bill Clinton even before the national pundits told us we should have. And I think the look on his face then, you know, I think they realized it's over. And now the issue is to bow out gracefully in a way that moves the party forward.
Well, I guess in we're focusing on this primary, as you say, and so I'm ignoring some of the comments about George Bush or our side of the aisle. And I'm not going to get into that right now.
You never thought you were going to be the Hillary spokesperson in this, did you, Margaret?
No. Well, I guess the interest. But I guess we're talking about the two sides and how the side is shaping. You know, how it will come together somehow. I think the interesting thing is that I see in Hillary Clinton, from purely a woman coming to that point, and all the things that are watched. I think her energy, her appearance, her poise, her articulate ability to be very forceful in her speaking amazes me from day to day when she, you know, jumps from one state to another and shows up the next day after a grueling primary as fresh as can be. I mean, women have the advantage, and even though people are critical of our wardrobes and whatever, there is makeup and there are colors that women can use to look very good, and whoever is helping her is doing a marvelous job. Having said that, I find it amazing that she has been able to step out of the shadow of her husband. I don't know if he could have given the speech she gave the other night. I don't know if he had it in him to do what she did as he was in her shadow at that point. The other point I'm finding interesting is this new discussion. Step away now, Hillary, and your real role should be take over Harry Reid's job in the Senate, because she is respected there. She's, I'm told, and I hear these stories that she works hard with both sides of the aisle. I hear all these things about her that I don't think we'd hear about Barack Obama at this point, because truly, even though you've said some specific things, Peg, he does not have any type of long history or credit to things on his credit side of what he has done there as a U.S. senator. So I think, you know, it's very interesting as the whole discussion has evolved, I think.
But Margaret, I mean, you know, if we're going to say somebody's been somewhere for 8 years or 6 years or whatever, I think he's been remarkably poised and thoughtful during this whole process. I mean, you know, here's a guy who came off of all of the, I hate to say the name out loud, but the Reverend Wright stuff and all of those different things. And that was a week ago. You know,
I agree completely that he's a poised and very articulate speaker.
You know, I mean,
speaker.
His speech he gave in New Hampshire, that concession speech in New Hampshire early on in the race, I thought that was one of the most brilliant concession speeches I had ever heard. In fact, it was one of the most brilliant speeches in victory, too, because he has been able to take the stuff that's thrown his way, and you know, and quintessentially turn lemons into lemonade in a way that I think shows a maturity as a candidate that you don't see in folks of his age.
Well, Barack Obama was making the rounds on Capitol Hill yesterday, apparently trying to talk to some superdelegates to get them to declare and to commit to him to try to unify the Democratic Party. Someone asked him, too, if he would select Hillary Clinton as his vice presidential running mate. And he said, there's no doubt she's qualified to be vice president. No doubt she's qualified to be president. She's tireless, she's smart, she's capable. So obviously she'd be on anyone's short list to be a potential vice presidential candidate. Is he just being tactful, Peg, or do you think Obama might?
Oh, I think he certainly sees merit in that possibility. I mean, there have been a number of names that have been thrown up or thrown out that are are good names. John Edwards, another possibility where, you know, Joe Trippi today, I think on one of the morning news shows, called it an historic kind of symbolic thing where you have somebody from south of Mason-Dixon line and somebody from the north running together in a way that would be very symbolic. You know, there are folks out there who are very, very good, and I think there are a number of possibilities. I'm not sure that she would be happy as a vice president. I think Margaret's thoughts on, you know, maybe Senate Majority Leader or some sort of position there. My sense is her real focus is policy. It always has been. It was during her husband's administration.
Let me take some more calls, and then we will move on. Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Just wanted to bring this up. You know, Hillary is talking about everybody's vote should count, and she's trying to bring this great impression that she wants everybody's voice to be heard, and she's going to fight for the voters. And then, because everything is pretty much mathematically impossible, she's going to overturn, you know, all the voters she's pumping up and going along and saying she's fighting for, by using the superdelegates to overturn any decision that they may make. And I just find it really hypocritical, and I wanted to get the guest's thoughts on that.
One of the biggest frustrations I've had in watching this campaign, and one of the reasons I've been as actively supporting Barack Obama as I have, is my frustration with the way the rules of the game keep changing. You might recall, too, Dave, that Hillary Clinton originally assumed that by Super Tuesday everything would be over and she was the presumptive nominee. And then her rules were very different. And it was, you know, Obama can't raise enough money, I've got the money. And then Obama started raising money. Well, then it became a different calculus that was used. One of her equations most recently that she's tossed out is that if this had been the Republican primary, I would have already been the winner because there's so many winner-take-all states, and yet she was among those who fought so tenaciously with her husband to make sure there was representation, proportionate representation among delegates from the various states. So in doing away with the winner-take-all primaries, which really empowered the bigger states in ways that was almost unfair. So, you know, and the rules keep changing, and I think for many of us it's been frustrating to see that because as we try to move forward later, it would have been much easier if everybody had sort of played by the same set of rules.
Margaret?
Well, I agree in that I think it was very unique in what went on within the Democratic Party, the fact that Michigan and Florida were being penalized because they pushed their primary dates way up, and then the agreement was that they just wouldn't campaign there. And then Hillary Clinton, I found it quite amazing that she went in and showed up and was out there. She probably would say not campaigning, but she was showing up in a lot of public places, saying a lot of public things prior to their primary in Florida, and now wants those votes to be counted. I think it's too bad that the whole thing happened the way it did within the party. But I think the fact that we're going, watching the Democratic Party move toward its convention without a settlement, certainly of those superdelegates or those two states at this point, is new to this era of politics. But, you know, I suppose I am a fossil, but I can remember as a high school kid with a back page of the paper keeping score as the first tallies were taken and the first votes were taken at the national conventions, because they were very much open and everything was being determined on the floor of the convention.
Absolutely. And you know, you might also remember, Margaret, when the Democratic Party was changing its rules and wanted to have delegates selected with primaries that were partisan in nature, where you registered for a party. And the legislature here grappled with that and said, you know, we wouldn't close our primaries, that we wanted open primaries. And I think you were serving at that time, weren't you?
Well, I'm not I quite honestly, I wouldn't want to be sure and say yes or no at this point. But I think the what we have seen, and what we should remind anyone paying attention to our country and our state's governments, states make up their own mind about those things. And I think I found interesting Tuesday, besides all the other conversations we've had about it with the two candidates, I found it interesting that in Indiana, whose law on photo ID was just affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, there were no problems. I heard of the very unique little story that we all heard, maybe of the 12 nuns who couldn't get, weren't able to vote because they had some disabilities that couldn't get them to get their photo IDs. But they didn't raise a ruckus. They understood, and they were fine with it. And that was the only story that could be found in Indiana of anyone not having the ability to vote at the primary and because of the photo ID requirement.
I don't know how John McCain polls with the nun vote, Margaret, but I think that what we hear are the stories about somebody who we somehow categorize as somebody who shouldn't be a voter, having voted, but we don't hear about the number of people who quietly get turned away and are disenfranchised from what I view as the most important right of a citizen in this country, and that is to vote. And we've created a nation of felons now with the way we've dealt with our criminal justice process. So I guess we have in some states, depending on state laws and whether or not they allow people who've served their time to have their rights to vote restored. But from my perspective, I think we're back to trying to weed out who we decide gets to vote and doesn't get to vote, and creating barriers to voting. And I think that's probably one of the most tragic statements on our democracy.
Well, my sense was in Indiana, knowing that this was the first time the state would react to their affirmed law, I'm sure the press was all over the polling places and looking for the real problems. And apparently everything that's been reported is they didn't find them. People were comfortable with it, were able to vote. And I agree with you, everyone should have the access to the voting, but I think there's a responsibility involved in that also. The only way we know who's voting is whether they live in the state or not, and I think there's a way to be able to be sure that that is the case.
Yeah. Well, you know, though, the photo ID doesn't necessarily give you a guarantee of that. There are a lot of people who have multiple driver's licenses. If you leave Wisconsin and take up a residency in Illinois and you get another driver's license, you still likely have your old Wisconsin license. I think that, this has become one of these buzz things that creates fear in folks that somebody who, quote, shouldn't get to vote is voting. And to me, having citizens feel like they're a part of their government, particularly in a democracy, is kind of a pretty fundamentally important thing.
Let me move on to one last call on Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, as we have other issues to cover and the time is running short. Laverne in Monroe. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
I think Hillary's just staying until all the states have voted, just like you're talking. Voting on another issue, but all the people should vote. Hillary's stronger on the economy. Her husband pretty well proved that in the last 4 years he was in. And I think the question you should ask, who has suffered more in the last 100 years, the women or the blacks? You can go down in Africa and see what the role of a black woman is.
Well, that's a different perspective than what I have, I can tell you that. I don't think that we need to question who's suffering here. I think what we're trying to do is figure out who can unite and who can move things forward. And from my perspective, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama can do that very, very well.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are both campaigning today in Oregon, one of the few states left as the Democratic primary season winds down. Clinton is telling supporters to ignore calls for her to bow out. Obama says he wants to bring the party together as soon as possible. What's your prediction, Peg, before we move on to some other issues? Is this going to be resolved, the first week of June after the primaries are over and we'll have a Democratic Party nominee, or is it going to go all the way to the convention?
My sense is it depends upon the tone she takes in the remaining primaries. I think that there's merit in allowing things to move forward and allowing her campaign to move forward. But if she continues with kind of the divisive sort of statements she's been making, particularly on race, I think at some point the so-called party elders and the superdelegates are going to start committing. And I think you see that already. I think Obama picked up two superdelegates yesterday, members of Congress. He's picked up quite a few in the last several days. And
George McGovern switching allegiances,
too. George McGovern switching. There were a lot of very symbolic sorts of commitments that have been made. And I think that you're going to see a steady kind of stream. You know, that's one of the things I've been most impressed with in his campaign is he's kept his bearings and he does things incrementally and thoughtfully. And so these kind of wild up and down swings aren't there like you see with some candidates. And I think you're going to see the same thing with the superdelegates, where he will keep chipping away at the superdelegates, keep chipping away at the pledged delegates through these last six states and move forward.
Well, Margaret Farrell, you can give us your prediction too, but I'm wondering, John McCain and the Republican Party probably happy to see this thing go on as long as possible, right?
Well, I think that there's certainly where it's just the flip side of what everybody would have predicted if we, again, would go back 9 months ago. People thought the Republican side, with all the candidates that were out there, were going to be the ones because, again, Hillary looked like she was just so strong she was going to roll over the rest of them by Super Tuesday. And so we've just seen this irony of the other way. Certainly, John McCain has not been the focus of the press, but he hasn't been in any way idle. People may not be watching as closely, but he has been working very hard up to this point. People are saying, who is his vice presidential candidate or nominee going to be? So there's all sorts of discussions of that type going on. My concern looking forward is I think it will go on until at least June on the Democratic side. I think if Obama is able to prevail and prevail at the convention, you'll have two people who each party feels and has reached the point is very capable of representing them in the general election. The concern I have at that point is certainly John McCain already has tried to make it clear he's going to stay on the high road with his campaign. My concern is that if Obama, who is very capable, no question about it, is the candidate, and anything begins to develop that is negative, I really am concerned about the racism label that is put on things, that if you oppose him on things, maybe he will never say it, but those around him in the third party, the independent groups, will charge racism. That slants the playing field out there very seriously, I think.
Well, first of all, I don't think that you have that sort of thing with my favorite always was Bill Clinton, who says that he's just like Jesse Jackson when he wins the South Carolina primary and then accuses the Obama campaign of setting it up and playing the race card when he was the one who blurted that out. But, I see a lot of that going on, too. My sense is that McCain has a real danger with these candidates continuing forward and getting the focus, because what I've seen him doing now is coming out with some outlandish policy suggestions. And I think a lot of times he seems like he has to push the envelope in terms of his policy statements he's making now, Margaret, in a way that can get media attention. If he comes out as the moderate he used to portray himself as, nobody pays attention. So he's doing these things as attention grabbers now in ways that I don't know that it's necessarily responsible or positive for him in the long term.
May not be the issue you're talking about, but let's touch on this one. John McCain criticized Democratic rival Barack Obama for voting against John Roberts as U.S. Chief Justice and reaching out to the Christian right on one of their chief concerns, the proper role of judges in government. He vowed that he would be appointing judges in the mold of Roberts and Sam Alito, saying they would interpret the law strictly and curb the scope of their rulings. Margaret Farrell, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think John Roberts has already proven his mettle. I think he is a very sound jurist. I think he's a good legal mind, and I don't see that as a negative, quite frankly. I think that people want constructionist, not revisionist justices. We've just proven it again in our state, and so I find that to be doesn't bother me at all. In fact, I'm pleased to hear it.
You know, it's interesting to me because this week the State Bar Association had its convention here in Madison. We also had an anniversary of the Milwaukee Bar Association where Sandra Day O'Connor spoke. And then we had not just Sandra Day O'Connor in the state, Jeffrey Toobin, who recently wrote the book The Nine, was here speaking at the State Bar talking about the Supreme Court. And he made a phenomenal observation that I think is so true, and that is tragically With this George Bush presidency, we have gone from thoughtful, the appointment of thoughtful jurists on the Supreme Court, where how they come out on issues of policy concern, such as Roe versus Wade, things like affirmative action, whatever, has always not been necessarily known. Tubin reminded his audience this week that it was a 7-2 vote on Roe versus Wade. One of the dissenters was a Kennedy appointee, Byron mm-hmm. White, and the other one was an Eisenhower appointee. With the appointments that have been made by, not by George Herbert Walker Bush, but by this George Bush, we have seen folks whose legal writings in the past, when they were solicitors general at the Department of Justice and whatever, were all geared toward political ends to legal questions and on these fundamental things. And, I think Sandra Day O'Connor's being in the state was a tragic reminder of how, you know, a brilliant judicial mind like hers is no longer a person, you know, someone with a brilliant judicial mind like hers is no longer a good candidate for the Supreme Court because it's become so politicized.
I need to take our break and then move on to many more issues. We'll kind of fire through a bunch of issues after this break. Talking with Peg Lautenschlager, an attorney with Lawton and Cates, former Wisconsin Attorney General, U.S. Attorney, legislator. Also talking with Margaret Farrow, former Lieutenant Governor and legislator, currently on the board of Wisconsin I. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn, talking with the author of a piece in the New York Times Magazine, Vote Like Thy Neighbor. Find out what that's all about coming up after 9 o'clock. We are reviewing the news of the week with Peg Lautenschlager and Margaret Farrow. A big international catastrophe, major disaster in Myanmar. I probably pronounced that wrong, but we have an email regarding that, and I lost it. Where'd it go? Do your guests think that President Bush spoiled U.S. humanitarian aid to Burma when he urged their military to create a democracy? Our aid's shipments are remaining in Thailand and are being denied entry by Burma. Peg, any thoughts on that?
Well, I guess in a general sense, I think, obviously I'm not in favor of the way in which this president has had no foreign policy in general, and particularly how he has, I think, very ineptly handled dealing with countries which do not have democracies, countries where human rights violations take place, that sort of thing. And so, from my standpoint, I think it's fair to say that I see this as being not surprising, given the way in which he has handled foreign policy. That being said, the government of Burma is tragic right now, and how we get aid in responsible ways. I know I got one email suggesting that there are organizations involving set up by some of the monks who we saw protesting not long ago in terms of trying to get aid out in a meaningful way. Today, the news, they reported that the dictator there was handing out DVD players and televisions to people in a country which barely has electricity right now. Yeah. So, it is a tragedy.
Margaret Farrell?
History, I know you're having a lot of fun bashing Bush regularly, but I think history is going to play a very different scene in terms of long-range view back of what has been going on in this world and how the United States has played a role in it. And I think history is going to pay him more respect than the present day, because I think the visceral, emotional hatred of this president is frightening, in my opinion, and not justified and not founded in logic by any means in terms of what has been going on. Having said that, I don't think the his anything we would have said would have reacted, would have caused the junta that is in Burma to have acted any differently. In fact, the UN planes are being stalled. The UN certainly should be welcome anywhere because of its moderate hand on how they react to people. Yeah. That we don't agree with. I think the fact that they have not been able to get in there in the efficient way any other government around the world would have welcomed them tells the tale of the problem being internal, not external. I think the other thing we have to keep in mind is this is an area of the world that has had many, many typhoons of this type that have taken many more lives individually than this one did. And so this is an area where people somehow live through this as our Tornado Alley, for example, in our country, rebuild and just somehow get the strength to do it. But they now, I think, need that help. It's ready to come from all parts of the world, including our own country and the United Nations. They think it's sad that a junta is sitting there in the way of their own people getting that aid.
Let me take another caller. Move on to some other issues. Bonnie and Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. I've been kind of upset this week about the joint U.S. Maliki assault on Sadr City, which is a huge slum with like thousands or millions of people in it, and the U.S. is conducting bombing raids there. And I understand that President Talabani disagrees with Prime Minister Maliki. President Talabani wants to negotiate with the people there because he knows they're mostly native. The people in the Mahdi army are mostly native to that section of the city. They're not foreign fighters or anything like that. And I'm afraid this is another human catastrophe in the making because thousands could be killed. And I was reading on Ron Cole's blog this week. He said that he thinks the warnings for people to get out, which are they're practically impossible for them to follow because he said slum dwellers are notoriously slow to vacate where they live. They lack the means of it. And I was even listening to Helen Thomas question Dana Perino, Bush's press secretary, on it the other day. And Helen was saying that these people live there. We should negotiate with them. There are millions of people, and this is going to create long-lasting, longer-lasting Iraqi resentment of the U.S. Incursion into their country.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that, Peg?
Well, let's just say I think Margaret and I squarely disagree on the foreign policy issues involving George Bush and how he's dealt with all of these things. From my perspective, obviously, I think that the U.S. foreign policy or lack of significant foreign policy is, and how it's been carried out is really put us behind the eight ball in terms of long-term relations with a number of people in the world. I would guess Margaret's on the exact opposite side from where I am on this.
Yeah. Margaret?
Well, I just think that there is an effort, no matter if we look at Israel just celebrating its 60th anniversary as a democracy, there's an effort that when you see injustice of man to a human being to human being within countries where something can be done to give the voice to those that are oppressed, as the caller just suggested, there is the oppressed group, as she was describing, there is the belief that human beings should try to help each other and should give them their own voice in their government. And I think that's been the underlying philosophy that has led George Bush and those supporting the efforts to bring democracy and to bring not our form of democracy, but the people's voice to their own governments to be heard and to get out from under oppression. And I think that's the motivation. And I think we've seen it across certainly the Middle East, and it's succeeded and it's failed in its efforts in certain places.
I guess I don't think we get there by bombing those people.
Yeah. Let me move on to another issue. And I'm sorry I'm being very brief here on all of these remaining issues. The House of Representatives passed a housing aid plan to provide $300 billion in refinanced mortgages for struggling homeowners. President Bush says he will veto the bill. The White House calls it a burdensome bailout that would open taxpayers to inappropriate risk and reward those who helped cause the housing crisis. Should he veto this housing aid plan, Margaret Farrell?
Well, I think he's going to, and I think one of the reasons is because it's a far-reaching solution to a problem perhaps that isn't clearly defined. When Barney Frank, who is the author of the bill, states that we're in this serious recession, Certainly, we are in an economic low right now, but we still are not in the theoretical recession that people are claiming it is, because we haven't had two consecutive quarters of downturn in the GNP. And he's out there saying something that is far broader in its analysis of what's going on in an erroneous way than it is. I think that there are ways that we should be reaching out. But I think it's far too expensive, and it's solving problems that are overstated in the way, and I in no way demean or lessen the impact on individual lives and people who are affected by decisions they made to get mortgages, and in getting those mortgages have put themselves in a position that is very difficult. They did it with their eyes open, and now somehow, yes, we should be helping, but this is an expensive solution.
You know, Margaret, everybody was quick to bail out the big financial institutions, which are giants in terms of political power, special interest might, and the like.
I didn't say that I agree with that either.
Okay, well, anyway, but I mean, you know, they bail out, you know, Bear Stearns and these places where executives are making ludicrous salaries, which, you know, 20 years ago we wouldn't have imagined, take the profits and run, and then blame the people who took out the mortgages in the first place. Well, you know, it was the irresponsibility and the need to make money now and make a lot of it now that caused these, you know, various people to get loans as they are. And, you know, and pretend we're not in a significant period of economic decline when it comes to our economy, and by all sorts of measures, there are real people out there facing a lot of hardship. And I think that when you get back to our, you know, we can come full circle now to the presidential election, and I think that's what's going to be McCain's biggest problem in this election, is he doesn't realize that there are those folks out there who need help now.
Well, yeah. I think what we've done is we've ridden a bubble up in an incredible growth of discretionary spending, and incredible growth of earning that led to that discretionary spending. And
by the government, too, I might add. How much are we spending in Iraq?
There's no question about it. The federal government, with its debt limits and the things that it has done, and the spending that people want it to continue to do on valid and not-so-valid programs, I would agree. You know me well enough here in the state that I fought wasteful spending on our state level, and still feel strongly about that. But I think the fact that we rode the bubble up and it's burst now is not going to be solved only by more government layering of solution. I think it's also going to have to be a belt tightening on the part of our individual citizens that mm-hmm. come to grips with how much they really earn and how much they are able to spend.
Let me get both of you to comment briefly, because we're almost out of time, on a new Badger poll showing 61% of those who were asked, they favor replacing the current health care system in Wisconsin with one that covers everyone and is run entirely by the state. We want universal health care run by state government. Margaret Farrell, what do you think?
Well, I thought it was interesting that in looking over the several questions that they put out on this, actually there was a drop since December, when the poll was taken in December, in terms of how many people really, really wanted this and really were pushing. It literally was a downturn from the high point in December. And to me, what that told me is people, it's a very complex issue. It's a very expensive issue individually and for businesses and for our state as a whole. And so I think there's still much to be...
I don't know what happened to Margaret Farrell, but Peg Lautenschlager, less than 30 seconds
okay,
anyway.
Okay, I think that we're going to have to deal with health care and recognize that it needs to be universal. It needs to cover pre-existing conditions, which McCain's plan doesn't do, and we've got to solve the problem. We have to solve it now.
Thank you so much, Peg Lautenschlager, and thanks very much to Margaret Farrell, who I trust can still hear me. Thanks to both of you for being here for the Week in Review. We will, by the way, focus on health care and health care reforms in Wisconsin in our state capitol report coming up Monday between 7 and 8. We'll talk more about universal health care and these poll results and what it means for health care reform in Wisconsin. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.